Several years ago, I was reminded of a very important lesson. I was coaching T-ball, and I think Todd Gray was helping me coach this year that this incident happened. We had a pair of brothers on the team, and one of them was extremely talented, and the other one just liked to play baseball, which is fine. But they both got the same talk from their mother before the game started, and she didn't know that I was listening. It was just out of really earshot, but I picked up on it pretty quickly. She gathered both of her boys together, and she said, "Just remember when you go out on that field that you're a testimony." And I thought, whew, I needed to hear that too, you know, because sometimes competition has a way of putting us in places and having attitudes that are really unbecoming of people that are following Jesus. So that's been a reminder that I've carried with me, you know, from coaching T-ball all the way through everything that we do. Sometimes we, as a family, sit around and ask, why do we show sheep like we do? Why do we try to go out and on Saturdays and do well? But before every show, we always have the conversation, our job today is not to win. Our job today is to be a light in a place that people need light. And today, as we get into Genesis chapter 4, we're going to really look at, you know, two lives. One's pretty short, the other's longer, and their lives paint a particular picture that's important for us. It has some meaning for us today. So today, when we get to Genesis 4, you can go ahead and flip there. I'm going to tell you, we're going to pick up the pace. We've been really taking things slowly in terms of how time is unfolding in our story. But one of the things I hope, if you've read ahead or you go home and read, I hope that you realize that when we get to Genesis chapter 4 and chapter 5, there's a lot of ground that's covered in a short amount of text. So here's an interesting piece of tidbit. This might be, if you ever end up on Jeopardy and they have a Bible question, you know, this might be one of those questions. The book of Genesis covers roughly 2,500 years of history. So the entire book covers roughly 25 years of history. Chapters 4 and 5 alone cover 1,500 of those years. So now you see what I'm talking about. The pace really picks up. We cover a lot of ground in just a short amount of space. So I think it's important to understand that, because one of the things that I struggled with this week as I was preparing, and I read this text over and over, and I read lots of commentaries and listened to a lot of things, and I continued to have the struggle, like, what's this about? What's this about? And the problem was, at the end of the day, when I stepped back, I realized, well, it's because I'm not looking at the big picture. Right, I'm looking for the plot line in this short chapter, and really, this is a part of a larger plot line that's going on. And when we keep that in mind, it helps us understand what we come to today. So if you're there, Genesis chapter 4, we're going to look at the first five verses real quick. I'm going to kind of break this down systematically, but I'm also going to tell you, you know, I've kind of built this whole series as this is like what it would be sitting in seminary, and I have toned it back quite a bit as I've gone through my notes. I've filtered some things out. But today, I'm going to take a step back, I think, from the depths, and I want to take a more pastoral approach to the text, because I think there's a lot of valuable content to some of the things that many of you are going through in your life, and myself included. So we get to Genesis chapter 4. I'm reading from the New International Version today, but I'm also going to sprinkle in where I've compared some different translations. Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now, Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. And Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Now, I'll tell you, you know, I use the NIV a lot, but I really think the NIV's translation of this, especially these five verses, is a very... it's one of the poorer translations. I don't think it stays real close to the original language, and I think that might impact how we approach this text. But here's one of the things that we have to keep in mind as we read these first five verses. We have to understand what Adam and Eve's expectations would have been when it comes to offspring. So if you remember last week when we hit Genesis 3, inside of Genesis 3, in verse 15, you'll remember as part of the curse, there's kind of this prophetic promise that God gives. The prophetic promise that God gives is, "And I will put enmity between you and the woman," he's talking to the serpent, "and between your offspring and hers." And in the next breath, he says, "He will crush your head and you will strike his heel." And so when we think about the position of Adam and Eve in this text, what they are doing is they are looking for a snake killer. They are looking for an offspring that is going to overcome the temptation of the serpent. Where they fell short, they're looking for a child that can make up for their inadequacies based on God's prophetic word. And Cain's name indicates that Eve believes he's the one. Now, notice that it's Eve who names Cain. Earlier in the book, Adam does the naming. And I think this tells us a little bit of something about men and women in the Bible. You know, men and women in the Bible are really equal. Eve has the ability to name just like Adam does. And so here she names Cain. And this is what Cain's name means. It means to acquire or to obtain. Now, this is the New American Standard version of Genesis 4:2. "I have obtained a child with the help of the Lord." And some translators have even suggested that this text could be translated, "I have obtained a child, even the Lord," depending on how you read it. So if you think in that frame of mind, what Eve is saying is, "I've had the Messiah. I've had the promised child. He's the one. He's the one that's going to crush the serpent's head." So in Eve's mind, Cain, the name, indicates, "I have obtained the promise of God." And then the text says, "And later she gave birth to his brother, Abel." Now, Abel's name is also significant. Abel in Hebrew means vapor, breath, or to ascend. Now, we could take this a couple different ways. Maybe Abel, the name, indicates the type of life that he led. I've heard some people argue, well, you know, he lived a short life. His name means vapor. You know, he was here briefly. But I think we have to ask the question, does the text really indicate that he lived a short life? You know, we don't know how old Cain and Abel were when, you know, spoiler alert, if you haven't read ahead, Cain's getting ready to kill Abel. We don't know how old they were when this happened. You know, age-wise in the Bible, they could have been in their hundreds. So I don't know that the translation short or vapor breath really indicates the length of life. But I think it goes back to this expectation of Eve. Eve has Cain. She says, "I've obtained the child of promise." And then Abel comes along and says, like, "Well, I hope he can ascend to the same status as his brother." And so there's kind of this disparity between the two. And Cain, in her mind, it seems textually that he's the one. And so Adam and Eve end up doing more than just raising Cain. They set out to prove that they're able parents. I'm glad some of you laughed. Yeah. I had a little note here that says, if nobody laughs, ask if they caught the joke. I told that to Abby, and she's like, "Dad, you're so dumb." Then she said, "What does that really mean? So who's the dumb one here?" Then we get to this point, you know, here they have these two different names. Here these have, their parents have different expectations for both of them. And they have two different occupations. One follows in his father's footsteps. Cain is a tiller of the soil, just like Adam. Abel becomes a shepherd. And both are very important occupations. I want you to understand that. Neither one is more distinguished than the other. And both of these men, what they do is they bring forth an offering that is related to their occupation. Some commentators would say, well, the reason God accepted Abel's offering is because he was a shepherd. You know, and Jesus is talked about as the good shepherd. That doesn't really hold any weight because God's the one that gave Adam the task of tilling the ground. And so Cain is following in those footsteps. They're both admirable things. They are both things that continue to push humanity forward. Both are needed to sustain life. So what's really going on here? Why does God favor Abel's offering over Cain's? Well, the text cues us into a difference between the two. And then when we go to the New Testament, we find another distinguishing mark between the two. In the text we just read, it said Cain brought some of the fruit of the soil. And then this is what it says about Abel. Abel, on his part, also brought an offering from the firstborn of his flock and from their fat portions. Now, the important thing here is in the details. Cain brought some. Abel brought from the firstborn. Cain brought what was left. Abel brought what was first. So textually, we see a difference. Abel, not really being the child of promise in Eve's eyes, he gives everything he has out of the firstborn to God. And then Cain, the promised one, the one who's going to fulfill the prophetic role, he just brings some. Now, when you go to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 4, you'll find that the author of Hebrews says there's another difference between Cain and Abel. It says, by faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain. Now, here's what's interesting. He says, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous. And I think it's really kind of a reversal here. Abel brings by faith an offering, and what does he do? He obtains the testimony that he was righteous. What Cain was supposed to be, Abel gets because of his faith, according to the author of Hebrews. And so there's some differences here. Their occupation, and this is important, I want you to write this down. Their occupation was part of their adoration. What they did, that which they produced from God's creation, was offered back to God as worship. Their livelihood was intertwined with their worship of God. Now see, sometimes what we have a tendency to do in our lives is we kind of segment our life into different silos. You know, this is our job, and this is church day, and this is sports day, or whatever. But for these men, their livelihood, it was intertwined with their worship. What they did impacted their relationship with their Creator. So here's some modern implications. This is where the rubber meets the road for us. Our work is part of our worship. What you and I do Monday through Saturday impacts our experience here on Sunday. That's what's important to get from this text. What we do Monday through Saturday impacts our experience here on Sunday. God's desire for us, he wants our best, not what's left. Colossians chapter 3, Paul wrote, verses 23 and 24, and whatever you do, do it heartily as unto the Lord and not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. What does that tell us? What you do is important. How you impact this creation through the occupation that you hold is important. And here's another takeaway from this. God can reject our worship without rejecting us. All right. God can reject our worship without rejecting us. This is what we're getting ready to get to. This is what he does with Cain. You know, it says God looked on Abel's offering with favor, but on Cain's he did not look with favor. It says nothing about him rejecting Cain. He rejected the offering. In worship, when we gather here on Sunday morning, it is a key time for us to discern where we stand with God.
You know, I think this is what we see happening here. We see these men who have worked and produced stuff through his created work. And they bring it to God in worship. And this is where they see where they stand with him. And I don't know how God showed that he approved one over the other. I don't know. Maybe it was like Elijah, the sacrifice that Elijah made with the prophets of Baal. Maybe, you know, whichever one spontaneously combusted, that's how they knew God favored that offering. I don't know. But what we do know is that these men brought forth an offering, both of them. One was accepted, one wasn't. One was the best, and one was what was left. And this is where God indicated, look, I approve of this life, and right now I'm not happy with this one. And God will do the same thing for us. He'll allow his spirit to show us areas in our lives that need to be addressed. Areas that we need to master before they master us. Let's move on. Verse 6. Now this shows Cain's response to God's disapproval of the offering. And what we're going to find, I hope you find as we read through these couple verses, that they're actually reassuring. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at the door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." Now here's why these verses are reassuring to me. Because God didn't reject Cain outright. God is still speaking to Cain. God is still holding a conversation with Cain. And what he's doing in this conversation is he is providing a path for Cain to take. And he's really setting before Cain the same scenario that was set before Adam and Eve in the garden. The choice is yours. The choice is yours. You could really say that God is giving Cain a pep talk at this moment. Look, Cain, everything that's going on is not good. But don't worry, you can overcome it. Sin is crouching at the door, but you have to master it. It's your choice. And this is the first time in the Bible that the word sin pops up, the Hebrew word kata. And it's really simple. It's not a religious word at all. It just simply means to fail or to miss the goal. And so when we think about this word sin is crouching at the door, Cain. Failure is right there. Missing the goal is right there. A simple definition of sin is failing to love God or failing to love people. Because as the story unfolds, that's what we see happening. First, we know that Cain is not really loving God with all of his heart because he's not bringing the first fruits. And then we're getting ready to see he really doesn't love his brother. He doesn't love people. He has a low regard for life. And so he's missing the goal. He's missing the opportunity to be the image of God. And God's warning him, you're in danger. Your anger is leading you down a deadly path. See, because his anger was affecting his love for his brother. And it's not just anger, it's jealousy. You know, anger and jealousy together are a deadly combination. As Cain gets angry, you didn't accept my sacrifice. Now, mom said I'm the obtained one. I'm supposed to be the favored one. And now he's jealous of his brother Abel. We'll go to verse 8. Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out into the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your blood cries out to me from the ground. Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from my hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on earth." Now notice the difference here between Adam's consequence and Cain's consequence. See, Adam's a tiller of the soil, and God says, you're going to continue to till the soil. It's going to bring forth vegetation, but it's going to be tough. The earth is going to produce fruit for you, but it's going to do so in the midst of thorns and thistles and weeds, and you're going to have to deal with that. But when we get to Cain here, it's different. God says, when you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. The thorns and the thistles don't matter. It's not going to produce any food. And you're going to be a restless wanderer on the earth. And Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is more than I can bear. Today, if you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence, I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. But the Lord said to him, not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times all over. Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. And that word Nod is just simply wandering, the land of wandering, or the land of wanderers. Now, God comes to Cain after he kills his brother, and he approaches Cain the same way that he approaches Adam in the garden. I hope you notice the similarities, because he begins with the question. In the garden, the question to Adam was, where are you? Now the question to Cain is, where is your brother? And so God's coming the same way he came to Adam to begin a conversation. He opens the floor for a conversation to take place. And just like Cain followed in his father's footsteps for his occupation, he also follows in his father's footsteps in his response to God. The apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, because Cain, just like dad, has a smart aleck remark to God. Am I my brother's keeper? You know, and I think it's so fascinating that part of Cain's curse is related to this statement. Because God proceeds to curse Cain, and he says, am I my brother's keeper? Now God says, okay, now you're going to wander, and you're not going to have a keeper. And we know that this is on Cain's mind, because they're going to be out to get me. Who's going to watch over me? They're going to be out to get me. And so part of his own fear, God uses that as part of the curse. And Cain has a problem with it. He has a problem with the punishment. He says, today you're driving me from the land. I'm going to be hidden from your presence. Now, did God ever say that? I'm going to be hidden from your presence. I'm going to be a restless wanderer, and whoever finds me, they're going to kill me. And so now the murderer is afraid of being murdered. The killer is afraid of being killed. Cain is banned from Eden and assigned to a life of wandering. And he's afraid that everybody's going to be out to get him. Nobody's going to be there to keep him. Now, here's what's fascinating about Cain. You know, just like last week, we see the question raises, how can God be so mean? How can he banish somebody? How can he ban Adam and Eve from the garden? How can he do this to Cain? But Cain lives a life of being banned and blessed at the same time. He's banned and he's blessed. Because God shows mercy to Cain. He protects Cain from retributive justice. Now, this is a thing in the Old Testament. If you follow the Old Testament, you'll know that there's a thing called the Avenger of Blood. If you kill somebody, the Avenger of Blood can kill you. It's kind of, in all reality, in some instances, our justice system in the United States is built off of this Old Testament concept of an eye for an eye. You know, murderers get killed. And so when we think about retributive justice, Cain is in line, just like he's afraid of, he's in line to get knocked off. But God shows mercy to Cain. Not only does he show mercy, he protects him from anyone that would want to avenge Abel's murder. Now, I don't want to get into this. I know some of you are saying, what's the sign? What's the mark? Some of your translations say, what's the mark? I don't know. Does it say? Nope, doesn't tell us. It just says that he put a mark on Cain, or some translations say he set a sign over Cain. Whatever it is, it indicates that, hey, if you do anything to Cain, God's going to avenge him. So God protects Cain. Now, here's what happens. He's driven further from the garden, out of Eden, but he's not killed. Okay? So here, we're going to take a pause from the text, and we're going to look at how this applies to us. What's the implications for us?
Well, believe it or not, anger can be a deadly problem to have. Be a deadly problem to have. Anger can destroy a family, can destroy a friendship, can destroy a marriage. Anger can lead you to take another person's life. It's a serious thing. I think this is why Jesus said, you have heard it said long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. Jesus goes on to say, but I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. You know, sin has consequences. Anger has consequences. But God is merciful. Cain didn't get what he deserved. You know, if we want to be real about it, Cain did not get what he deserved. But the beauty of it is neither do we. Neither do we. We don't get what we deserve. We get mercy. We get grace. If you go back to verse 16, it says, so Cain went out from the Lord's presence, and he lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Now, there's something very fascinating taking place here. And I showed you my approach here to... We have the middle of the garden with the trees, right? And then we have the garden. Then we have Eden. And then we have the land. Now, what happens? First, Adam and Eve are living in the garden. They have access to the trees in the middle. And then they get pushed out to Eden here. And they can't come back in the garden. Now, chapter 3 is about the root of sin. And chapter 4 is about the fruit of sin. And when we get to the fruit of sin, when Cain takes it to the next level, it's no longer just pride. It's no longer just saying, I'm going to do this my way. Now it's taking a life. Cain gets pushed out of Eden. Notice the text tells us that he goes, you got to leave. You got to go east of Eden. And so textually, what I think is going on here is what we find is the deeper we get into sin, the further we get away from that place where heaven meets earth. The deeper we get into sin, the further we get away from God's presence. Now, we can't say that God's presence is completely gone in this text because we know God's still coming down to having this conversation with Cain. But it gets harder and harder for Cain to relate to God the further and further he gets away from the garden, from that place where heaven meets earth. And it shows us the disastrous effects of sin and life. Because what we're going to find, you know, as we continue to work through this, is now this thing is kind of spiraling out of control. Right? You get the disobedience in the garden. You get the murder of Cain, killing his brother. And then you get to, in just a moment, we're going to see this fellow Lamech. And then you get to Genesis chapter 6. And now it becomes, the Lord God saw that every inclination of the thought of the human heart was always evil all the time. And so it's this perpetual spiraling out of control. The further we get from God, the worse things get. So we get to verses 17 through 24. And this is really Cain's lineage. This is Cain's family tree. It's laid out here. And we're going to see there's some individuals that play some important roles in human advancement. And there's one person that's highlighted that shows the fruit of sin continues to increase. All right. I'm not going to read it all to you. You can read those verses, but I want to point some things out. Here's the bad. Lamech is bad. The picture that's painted of Lamech is worse than Cain. Lamech has no regard for human life. At this point, we get to a place in the text where humans have a substantially lowered view of humanity themselves compared to the first three chapters. Remember, the first three chapters, the view of humanity was really high. God prizes humanity. It's extremely important. People are important. And now we get to the point where we get, well, Cain killed somebody else. Life's not super important. And now we get to Lamech. And Lamech has two issues, really.
Lamech, for the first time in Scripture, he takes two wives. Not one, two. And the text indicates that he forcefully takes the wives in the original language. Why? He doesn't have any value for women. I'm just going to take them, they're mine. Goes against God's mandate, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, one. Now Lamech, what's that? Two, I want two, maybe more. And then we see him boasting about his exploits. He says, I have killed a man for wounding me. The Hebrew says, I have killed a man for wounding me, a boy for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. And it's a picture of this spiral, spiral, spiral. But in the middle of this spiral, there's something good that's going on here. Because Lamech has kids. He has three children, two different wives. And even though Lamech is pointed in a negative light, his children are shown to have helped with society. One of his children, they specialize in raising and breeding livestock. Another, they specialize in music, playing instruments. And it's important to culture. Music is important to culture. And then the third child is responsible for developing metallurgy. And all three of these things add value to community, add value to culture, and those are good things. And when I look at this story of Cain and his kids and his grandkids and his great-grandkids, what I see, and this is where it really hits for us, that God's plan for creation to flourish and for people to be co-creators can move forward despite the evil that is present in the world. That's what this tells me. That even though there's evil present, even though there are people that are bad, even though there are people that are murdering and killing and angry, God can use individuals to push forward creation and to add value to life. But we're still left with an unresolved problem. That's where we get to in this lineage. You get Cain, and then you get all these kids that follow, grandkids that follow, and we're still left with the problem. It's the problem that we started the chapter with. Who is the offspring that's going to crush the serpent's head? Because now we know it's not Cain. We know it's not his kids. Who's it going to be? Then we get to verse 25. And Adam made love to his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth, saying, God has granted me another child in place of Abel, since Cain killed him. Seth also had a son, and he named him Enosh. At that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord. Seth. Now, Adam made love to his wife. That's how we started the chapter. That's how we end the chapter. That's the inclusio part. This tells us that we're wrapping up this section of thought. Here we have it. We still have a problem. We need a serpent. We need a serpent killer. We need somebody that can overcome. She gave birth to a son. She named him Seth. The name Seth means to set something in place. To set something in place. Now, Eve's approach to this child's a little bit different. Because before we said we could argue that I have obtained the one, even the Lord, the promised one. Now we get to the point where she said, God has granted me, and this is pretty true to the text, God has given me another child. I didn't bring this one into the world. God gave me this one. And his name is to set something in place. What is that? Well, I'm going to give you chapter 5 in a nutshell because we're not covering it next week. Chapter 5 traces Adam's lineage through Seth. Through Seth to Noah. Now that's important. Okay. So here's what you need to know about chapter 5, because I'm not going to pick it apart. Chapter 5 takes Adam to Seth. Seth all the way through his lineage down to Noah. Noah's the turning point in the story. But here's what chapter 5 is all about. God has set something in place. God has set something in place. It's very important. It's part of the bigger picture. It's not just important to this story. It's important to the whole story of the Bible. God has set something in place through Seth that eventually we'll come to this. We can trace that, Jesus, all the way through this lineage of Seth, the appointed. So set something in place. It's not Seth, it's somebody else that's coming. Sorry. In chapter 5, this is the next thing. We read these names and they live 800 years, 900 years, 600 years. These people are living a long life. That's what we think, right? We read this. The key is, remember, patterns are important. He lived so and so years and then he died. That's important. Why is that important? Because what God say? Man's not going to live forever. And then he died. And then he died. And when we take outside text, I said there's these other creation myths out there. And these other creation myths, I was talking to Gary earlier this week at the ball field. In their stories, people live thousands, tens of thousands of years. And so when they read this story of creation, they say, wow, those people lived a really short life. God was right. They didn't live a long life, and they died. That's chapter 5. Now, come prepared next week for chapter 6. The wickedness in the world, more evil, and God's response. So here's what I want you to take away from this today. This is it. I'm landing the plane. I think when we approach this text from the standpoint of what really does it mean for us? Look, we all live a banned life and a blessed life at the same time. We're in exile still. We are not at that place where it's the final spot for humanity to be. We're not there yet. We're outside of that. We're banned from that to an extent. We can get bits and pieces. We can get a taste of what it's like, but we don't get the full experience now. But at the same time, we're extremely blessed. God shows us mercy and grace and love and compassion. And the response that he's looking for is just the best of your life. Not the leftovers from life. He wants the best of your life. He wants whatever you do to be an offering, a sacrifice to him. That's what Paul talks about in Romans, a living sacrifice. And so the question I want to leave you with is, what have you laid on the altar for him? Let's pray. Father, I pray that your Spirit would continue to speak to us through your word. That like these two men who brought an offering before you as worship, it indicated to them, you showed them, where they were at with you. And God, we pray the same thing this morning, that you would show us where we stand. And it's so beautiful that you come to Cain and you say, here's the problem, and here's how you can get around it. And you do the same for us. God, show us the flaws in our life. But help us not to have the response of Cain. Help us to be humble and acknowledge that you're being merciful. God, I pray that all of us would think about each day of life as a sacrifice. It's a life of offering to you. And I pray that we would bring our best, not what's left. And I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.